This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740.
Canada, The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio, AM 740.
Welcome to the Audio Imaginarium. Come on in, weary traveler, hang your cloak on a peg, grab a stool, and come gather around the fire. There are stories to be told, and you are among friends. Roswell investigator Thomas Carey is here. He is the co-author, along with Don Schmidt, of a brand new book on Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And Thomas will be here for the full 2 hours. The true nature of what actually crashed in Roswell, New Mexico in 1947 remains classified. Only a selected few have ever had access to the truth. But what happened to the remnants of that crash is shrouded in even greater mystery. What began in the high desert of New Mexico ended at Wright-Patterson, an ultra-top-secret Air Force base in Dayton, Ohio. The physical evidence of extraterrestrial visitation was buried deep within this nuclear stronghold. How tragic that such seismic news should be kept from the people of the world. Pieces of history now quickly dwindling into oblivion as the last of the secret keepers passes on. Thomas J. Carey has a master's degree in anthropology from California State and has also received a fellowship to pursue a PhD in anthropology at the University of Toronto. Thomas became interested in UFOs while in high school and rekindled that interest in 1986 when he became the MUFON State Section Director for Southeastern Pennsylvania. Since 1991, Tom's research has focused solely on the so-called Roswell incident. He is the co-author, along with Don Schmidt, of UFO Secrets Inside Wright-Patterson, Eyewitness Accounts from the Real Area 51. Thomas Carey, welcome to The Conspiracy Show. How are you?
Nice to be with you, Richard. Beautiful day today, and let's have at it.
All right. First of all, we have to note, of course, the book is dedicated to Stanton Friedman. He wrote the foreword to UFO Secrets Inside Wright-Patterson. Last week on the program, your co-author, Don Schmidt, and I, we did an hour tribute to Stanton. Let me just get your thoughts on the passing of this giant ufologist recently.
Well, he certainly was a giant. He was the go-to guy when anybody wanted to do a documentary. Since the late 1970s, early 1980s, he was the point person for all things UFO. And without Stanton, we wouldn't be talking here tonight about Roswell or the UFO secrets at Wright-Patterson. Because when he was giving a talk down in Louisiana, I think it was Baton Rouge, Louisiana, 1978, somebody said, one of the producers of the show said, you ought to talk to this fellow who was Jesse Marcel. You ought to talk to him because he says he handled pieces of wreckage from a UFO. And on his way out, Stanton called him, and thus began the civilian investigation of Roswell. Without that phone call, there's no Roswell story.
Remarkable.
So Stanton, he is one of the few, I'll have to say, that actually made a living out of UFOs with all the speeches he gave, you know? And a lot of people go into UFO, I'm going to have a magazine or something. But Stanton was totally dedicated to, quote unquote, UFOs are real. That was his first big message. And every summer or every July, Don Schmidt and I, we go down to Roswell, and they have the UFO festival down there. And Stanton is at a table right next to us, and it's not, just not going to be the same this year. We had him do the foreword for our book, and we dedicated this book to Stanton, the one we're talking about tonight.
Yes.
And it was just we didn't know anything, you know, that anything was amiss, and I don't want to use the word fortuitous, but it was ironic that this book we're talking about tonight was dedicated to Stanton, and he actually wrote the foreword to it. So he will be severely missed. I don't know what else to say. I know it won't be the same down there in next month without him.
Right, right.
And I looked upon him as a colleague. We were both on the same side of history. And we were, I guess, colleagues more than competitors, because we both believed in the Roswell case was a case of extraterrestrial visitation. We disagreed on a few, not many, a few things, a witness or two, MJ-12 papers and things like that, but that never stood in the way of anything, because I'm sure he disagreed with us, but we both recognize, and this goes for Don as well, that we're on the same side fighting the battle next to one another instead of against one another.
Sure. I've heard you and Don talk about how when it came to the Roswell investigation, you were and are in a race with the Undertaker, because not only the witnesses are gone now, many of the children of the witnesses are getting up there in age, and many of them have passed on.
We even have some grandchildren that have passed on.
Right. Right.
Yes, I would estimate, as we're talking here, that the 99% of the firsthand witnesses, the participants, and that sort of thing, are either gone or at that stage in life where you can't interview them.
Right.
You know?
Right.
They're just gone, and I'm sure there are a few still out there that have something to say, but we don't know who they are. And they're not coming forward.
And likely they'll take what they know to the grave.
Yes.
But would this be a fair assessment that the trail in Roswell is, as we say, you know, you're in a race with the Undertaker. It's almost cold, but now you can pick it up at Wright-Patterson Airfield, which you have done with Don in your work.
Yes. This book we have out tonight came out about 2 weeks ago. And it's like the crash and recovery was the first stage or the first chapter. The delivery and what happened to it after it got to Wright-Patterson or Wright Field back then is the second stage of the case. First stage was the crash, recovery. The second stage is what went on at Wright-Patterson after the bodies and the wreckage were delivered there. That's what this book is about.
Right. Now, it's interesting because Wright-Patterson, like Area 51, is shrouded in secrecy. But unlike Area 51, we actually know a fair bit about the origins of Wright-Patterson, its beginnings. And you talk about its early history in UFO Secrets Insight Wright Pat. Just tell us a little bit about its origins involving the Wright brothers and so forth.
Yes. First of all, and I do this when I give a talk, I say, how many of you in the audience have ever heard of Area 51? And all the hands go up. How many of you have heard of Wright-Patterson? And very few hands go up. But Wright-Patterson was basically Area 51 before there was an Area 51. The Wright brothers had a bicycle shop in Dayton, Ohio, and they started working on this newfangled contraption called an aeroplane. And, of course, they had the first flight down in North Carolina at Kitty Hawk somewhere around 1903. And so they bought a stretch of land outside of Dayton, Ohio, at a Huffman Plain. It was a flat area. And so that's where they started developing, continuing the development of their airplane. But they lost control of the land mass there with World War One. When World War One came along, the U.S. government confiscated the Huffman plane, and they put up another. They put up an airport. Now, I don't want to go through all the names of because they went through so many different names for these two airfields. It was Wilbur Wright Field, and then the other one was see, I'm already mixed up with it. There were two locations. One was Wright Field, and the other was Patterson, which was named after a World War One flyer who was killed landing there. And so you have Wright Field and Patterson Field. And it really came to prominence during World War II. During World War One, it was more like a supply depot where they supplied a lot of things to the nascent Air Corps, as it was called. But World War II comes along, and it really expands. And they have divisions now. They have intelligence. They have engineering. They have supply. It was basically the heart and soul of the Air Corps, or as in World War II, it was called the Army Air Forces. And it was the beating heart of the Air Corps. And part of that was they had a division called the Air Materiel Command, and that was divided up into intelligence and engineering. So what they wanted to get their hands on were crashed or captured Axis aircraft, Messerschmitts, Mitsubishis, and things like that, to see what made them go and how we could defeat them in battle. And that was the job of the Foreign Technology Division. Now, the Foreign Technology Division went through many name changes, and my head spins when I try to keep track of them, but we'll just call it
T2. At this time, wasn't it?
Yes, it was T2, yes. Then it became, I think, ATIC, then it became FTD, and I think it's NASIC now, but I could be wrong on that. And I won't apologize if I'm wrong, because they went through so many name changes. But it was intelligence, and the Messerschmitts and Mitsubishi Zeros went to – there was a hangar there, Hangar 23. Mm-hmm. That's where all of the foreign technology went to try to reverse engineer – tear them apart to find out what made them tick, how we could defeat them. So when this, and it keeps expanding, and intelligence was there, and it was the heart and soul of the Army Air Forces during World War II, and then the U.S. Air Force when it became a separate branch in September of 1947, right after the Roswell crash.
Right, right. We get into so, the summer of 47, the UFO panic, as you call it, or the Pentagon panic in 1947.
Yes.
At that point, was General Nathan Twining, was he stationed at, was he in charge of T2 at Wright Pat?
Yes. General Nathan, I forget his middle initial. Nathan F. I think it's F. Twine. Anyway, he was in charge of T2 Air Materiel Command. I don't know. He had either three or four stars. He ultimately became the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff with 4 stars. And we were good friends with his son, Nathan Jr., who really taken with our work on Roswell. And so Nate Jr. became a good friend of ours. He passed away, I want to say, 2 years ago.
Right.
So, Air Materiel Command was FTD, Foreign Technology.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was going to ask you about the timing because of the Twining memo, which is held out as, you know, one of the great sort of smoking gun documents. Here is Nathan Twining talking about these craft, flat on the bottom, domed on the top, the aerial maneuvers. They can, you know, outmaneuver anything that we have. I don't think it's a Soviet craft. What could it be? He's sort of reaching out, asking. Now, if he's at Wright-Patt at this point, and he's seeing probably, you know, crash debris from the latest and the best, you know, aircraft from our adversaries. I'm just wondering about the timing of that. Did that memo come out before Roswell, after Roswell?
Oh, that was September of 1947. So it was a month or so after the crash, yes. He was responding to a letter or memo, whatever you want to call it, from Brigadier General Shulgin in Washington, because he was getting he was in intelligence in Washington with the Air Corps, Army Air Corps, soon to be U.S. Air Force. He was getting a lot of questions about flying saucers, as they called them back then. And so he wrote to T2 in Wright-Patterson. What can you guys tell me? You know, I got these people on my back. They want to know about this. I don't know what to tell them. And so that's what Twining was responding to. He gave a list of things that he says the flying saucers are not something fictitious. They were real. And then he gave a list of reasons of their characteristics. And that was the so-called Twining memo, which went to Brigadier General Shulgin in intelligence in Washington.
Well, I mean, that's the timing is important. If it's September 47 and Roswell July 47, and so at that point, one would suspect the crash debris had already arrived at Wright-Patt and Twining might have already had a chance to look at it.
Well, we have stories that Twining, when the crash happened, right after it happened, he flew, whatever his itinerary was, he flew to Alamogordo, New Mexico, to view the wreckage and some of the bodies. And so that's, we don't have that part nailed down, but there's a number of witnesses who said that Twining went to Alamogordo for a couple of days, right when the crash happened. But we do know as for fact now that the wreckage went to Wright Field, as it was called back then, right after the crash. This would be it started the first flight to Washington was a special flight on July 6th. 1947. This is before all the wreckage is even coming into the base. It's part of the stuff that Jesse Marcel brought back, and Washington wanted to get a look at this stuff ASAP. So on the 6th, there's a special flight to Washington with some of the wreckage. So they got it. We know they got it on the 6th, but the stuff started going to Wright Field starting on the 7th. And then the 8th and the 9th, that includes the bodies. So that first week, a little more than a week of July, most of that stuff is already at Wright Field. So Twining absolutely had a look at it.
Now, in terms of the chronology here, now Jesse Marcel, he originally accompanied the wreckage to Fort Worth, correct?
Yes.
And then didn't Roger Ramey unofficially, at least, officially cancel, saying you're not going to Wright Pat. It was supposed to go from Fort Worth to Wright Pat, and then officially, at least on the record, he said, "No, we're not flying to Wright Pat."
Yes, that was all histrionics, Richard. He had the press there, plus some others, and they had the balloon on the floor, and there were all these rumors about little bodies and flying saucer, and he canceled that flight. We got the stuff here. There's no need for that flight. Cancel that flight. Well, it never was canceled. We know that's a fact because all the stuff did go there, but there's a telex from the FBI, from the FBI office in Dallas, that they learned from Ramey's, one of his high officers there. I don't know if it's the chief of staff or the public information officer, a guy named Curtin. The FBI learned from him that the flight was not canceled, and it's all in a memo from FBI Dallas to the director with a copy to Cincinnati that the fact that it was canceled is not true, that the flight is on its way to Wright Field. So we have a document that shows that, plus we know from eyewitnesses that it arrived at the Wright Field at that time.
One of those witnesses would be Captain Oliver Pappy Henderson, who actually piloted the plane, correct?
Yes. Pappy Henderson had the second flight, the so-called second body flight, plus some wreckage. He had the first body flight on July 8th. Where one of the C-54 aircraft that flew directly from Roswell to Wright Field without stopping in between. He flew wreckage and he flew bodies. And the bodies upset him because he didn't, according to he told a friend that he didn't like dead things. He just didn't like dead things. And he only glanced at the bodies that were on the floor inside the hangar. He said they had big heads and slanted eyes, and they just made him. He started getting queasy. But he saw enough that they weren't human. And his flight, we've identified one crewman on his flight. And it went straight to Wright Field on July 8th. 1947. This is the same day as that press conference in General Ramey's office where he canceled the flight. Pappy Henderson's flying to Wright Field. And of course, the press didn't know about that. They were thinking of the Marcel flight because Marcel was originally ticketed to go from Fort Worth to Wright Field. But Ramey canceled that flight, or so he said.
All right.
But meanwhile, all that's taking place. Pappy Henderson is already flying directly to Wright Field from Roswell. The press didn't know about that.
Thomas, we'll take a quick timeout. We'll pick it up on the other side. UFO secrets inside Wright Patterson. Eyewitness accounts from the real Area 51. This is The Conspiracy Show. My name is Richard Serrett. Stay with us.
Providing the evidence and letting you draw your own conclusions. This is The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett on Zoomer Radio.
We are back with Thomas Carey, co-author, along with Don Schmidt, of UFO Secrets Inside Wright-Patterson, Eyewitness Accounts from the Real Area 51. We were talking about Pappy Henderson, who piloted the plane containing the Roswell UFO crash debris and bodies to Wright Pat. And you mentioned Building 23. And I want to talk about, you know, this is part of the mythos of Wright Pat is we all talk about Hangar 18, Hangar 18, but there isn't a Hangar 18. How did that get started, Hangar 18?
That was one of the interesting things about doing this book. Was that we finally solved what happened with that Hangar 18 story. And there was never a Hangar 18 per se. But what happened was on the base, there was what they called the Building 18 complex. It consisted of buildings, Building 18 through 18G, nine buildings there. In that complex, there's one hangar, Hangar 23. That's, remember now, that's that hangar where all that back engineering stuff went.
Right.
During World War II. One hangar in that complex, and it's Hangar 23. So where and when did that, could that be Hangar 18? Could that be the Hangar 18 that people were talking about? So we did a backtracking, and I first went to the book, The Roswell Incident, by William Moore and Charles Berlitz. Actually, it was Stanton Friedman, but Stan didn't have a big name, I guess, at that time. I don't know, but the Roswell Incident mentioned nothing about a Hangar 18. But I remembered that there was this movie called Hangar 18 that came out the same year as the book.
Right. 1980. Darren McGavin.
No. The guy, Man from U.N.C.L.E. Robert Vaughn.
Robert Vaughn. But McGavin was in it, too.
Was he in it, too?
Yes.
So I'm sitting there watching. I remember I was sitting there watching Johnny Carson one night. And on comes Darren, Robert Vaughn. And Johnny says, well, how you doing, Robert? What's up? He said, well, I just finished the movie. What's it called? Hangar 18. But the thing was, when he said that, I knew what he was talking about. So I must have heard it from somebody earlier, but I didn't know where. So we contacted the screenwriter / director of the movie Hangar 18, a fellow by the name of James Conway. We said, okay, Jim, where did you hear this Hangar 18 thing? He says, oh, I heard that. It was being talked about, bandied about in the early 1970s. So I'm thinking, oh my goodness, what is that? So that didn't lead me to the promised land. So I'm an Air Force veteran. I get the Air Force magazine. I think it's bi-monthly. It's not monthly, but I subscribe to the Air Force magazine. And they did a story a couple of years ago about UFOs, how the Air Force was they did a really good job. They didn't deserve all the calumny that they got from their handling of UFOs. But in that story, they talked about Roswell, and they said, Hangar 18, this fellow in Florida, this professor in Florida, started talking about Hangar 18, where all the bodies were stored. And I said, oh, that's right. And what that was, Richard, I remembered now that in 1974, I was just about to get on a plane to go to Toronto to start my 4 years of schooling there. Mm-hmm. And all the talk was from this so-called Professor Robert Spencer Carr talking about Hangar 18 and all these flying saucer bodies. That's where they were stored. I remember that like it was yesterday, but I had forgotten it. It started with this fellow in Florida. He was no professor. He had a high school education, but he was like a UFO buff. And he got Florida. It was a great retirement place for military, right?
Sure.
And he heard the stories about this Hangar 18 at Wright-Patterson from all these retirees that would come up to him after he would give a talk. They go, I know this thing. Up at Wright-Patterson, they got this Hangar 18 where all these bodies are stored. So that's where the story got into the public domain. But why was it called Hangar 18 if there is no Hangar 18? Well, in the book, which I'm holding, in the book we have a schematic of Area B at Wright-Patterson, where it shows the Building 18 complex. And there's that one hangar in Building 18, that complex, Hangar 23. It's commonly referred to as Hangar 18 because it's in that 18 complex.
Right, right.
All those buildings in there are Building 18A, 18B, so and so and so and so. So they just started calling it Hangar 18. But it's really Hangar 23. But common parlance, it's Hangar 18. And interesting enough, right across the back alley from Hangar 1823, there's Building 18F. And that's the cold, that used to be the cold storage building before they had air conditioning. And that's where the bodies were kept. Because we have a guy that used to work in a building near there. He said on hot summer days, you got the smell coming out of there. It smelled like dead fish.
Right. You know? And formaldehyde.
And formaldehyde.
Right, right.
And because the vents inside opened to the outside. And this is before air conditioning. And he said, oh, it smelled like formaldehyde. Another fellow said it smelled like dead fish. So the proximity of the two, the back engineering of the wreckage and the storage of the bodies early on, right there.
Between the Conway screenplay and this car gentleman down in Florida, they gave the folks at Wright-Patt kind of cover, because every time a researcher or a tourist started poking around saying, can I see Hangar 18? They could honestly say there is no such building.
And there never was. Yes. Yes.
I want to talk.
Absolutely right. But it's a play on words. They should say, okay, show what's the building where the bodies were kept. In fact, we have it in the book. We have people who talk to workers at Wright-Patterson. They told them, they said, yes, the bodies are here, but I don't know where they're at. They admit now that the bodies were there or are there when they were questioned, but they would say, I don't know where, but they're here.
Wow. Listen, when we come back, I want to delve into the Foreign Technology Division a little bit. We'll talk about attempts to reverse engineer. We'll talk about Colonel Philip Corso and his testimony, and whether his testimony was credible. And we'll get further into the Building 18 complex, Hangar 23, and Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. My guest, Thomas Carey, co-author of UFO Secrets, Inside Wright-Patt, Eyewitness Accounts from the Real Area 51. Back with more of The Conspiracy Show. My name is Richard Serrett. Don't go away.
Take a look around. What do you really see? This is where you can tell all about it. The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett on Zoomer Radio.
Thomas Carey, co-author, UFO Secrets, Inside Wright-Patterson, Eyewitness Accounts from the Real Area 51. There's a great quote in the book, and I can't remember who it's attributed to, but it speaks to the whole conundrum of trying to reverse engineer when we're talking about, 1947, and you had this, advanced alien technology, but you have, the terrestrial science of the day. So the quote is, if you can't plug the thing in, you can't get it to work, or something to that effect. If you don't know how to plug it in, you're not going to figure out how it works. So talk to me about, the challenges they must have had trying to back engineer, reverse engineer this technology. And what would have been, do you suppose, the procedure?
We got it from people who were given the wreckage. As to what the procedure was, they his name was Elroy Center. He was a chemical engineer. They said one day they dumped this wreckage on my desk. They said, figure out what this stuff is. And so they gave that to various people with different specialties, and no one knew what the other was doing. See, that's the old compartmentalization, you know. And so they'd give it to a chemist. They'd give it to a physicist. They'd give it to some different people to try to figure out what made this stuff tick. And that's how they did it. There was no there was no procedure for this other than, you know, you can't compare a Mitsubishi with a ship that just traveled through the stars, you know. But they did their best. And we even heard years later that they still hadn't figured out what it was. So that's how they did it. They also, right up the street was this Battelle Memorial Institute. It was a combination think tank and metallurgy place. They farmed out this memory metal. This, you can't cut it, you can't destroy it, and you can wad it up in your hand and it just floats out there. And they gave a contract to the Battelle Memorial Institute in 1948 to figure out what this memory metal was and to try to replicate it. And it took them years to do it. And they came up with something called nitinol.
Yes. Dr. Frank Wang.
Yes. And we had one of our associates interview Dr. Wang, and everything was going fine until our interviewer mentioned Roswell. And boy, the guy couldn't hang up fast enough. And there were long pause, and he says, I won't talk about that, something like that. But that's what they did. They farmed it out to Battelle. We even had another fellow from Lawrence Livermore, another laboratory owned by Battelle out in California. He even sent us a picture of a little piece of this stuff. Doesn't look like much. It's just like a little square. And so they did their best, and they came up with something called nitinol. It's an amalgam of nickel and titanium. And there's a special processing that goes with it that was pointed out by General Arthur Exxon, who was the base commander in the mid-60s. He said, someone asked him, well, what's that stuff made out of? And he says, well, one of the elements is titanium, and I don't know what the other is, but the processing is different, which turned out to be true. So they put this amalgam of nickel and titanium together, and so you have NITI, and the NOL, it's interesting. The project leader at Battelle farmed out this project also to the Naval Ordnance Lab in Washington. You see the Washington or Maryland. The Naval Ordnance Lab. So in 1962, instead of having Battelle announce the discovery or the development of this self-shaped, self-healing metal, nitinol, the Navy did it. And that's where the NOL, it stands for NI, nickel, TI, titanium, NOL, Naval Ordnance Lab. Actually, what they did is they laundered the project to the Navy. See, so they didn't, Battelle didn't want any part of this.
Any connection to Roswell.
Yes, yes. So they laundered it to the Navy, and they announced this nitinol. It's not as good as the original. I mean, the original was indestructible, but you can buy it by the sheet, by the roll, you got eyeglasses. The frames are made out of nitinol, some of them, because it has bendability, and it's based on Roswell memory metal.
Fantastic. Listen, we'll take another quick time out, Thomas. We'll come back and talk about some of the other reverse technology projects at Wright-Patterson. Back with more in a moment. Stay with us.
This is no place for the naive or the faint-hearted. The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serra from Zoomer Radio.
Thomas, you were just about to tell us the story of then Lieutenant Governor, sort of second in command in New Mexico, Joseph Montoya, who happened to be at the 509 airfield when the debris, I guess, the crash debris was taken to the airfield. What was he doing there?
He was there dedicating an aircraft. And the wreckage and the bodies started coming in when he was there. And you have to figure that the base commander went on leave. We know he didn't go on leave. He went out to the crash site. The governor of New Mexico split. He was supposed to be going down to Roswell to dedicate the Air Force Day or something like that. He split to the mountains. It was like all people in positions of authority that might be called upon for an explanation. They all got out of Dodge.
Right,
know?
Right.
So that left Joseph Montoya by himself. And he had a few Montoyistas or young people who were supporters of his. They were called Montoyistas. And so he went over to the hangar area to visit with them. And while he was there, in comes the first parts of the wreckage and the little bodies. And he lost it. He said, "Oh my goodness, what is this?" And he saw the little bodies with the big heads. And he says, where's the phone? Get me the nearest phone." So he called, a local Montoyista in Roswell. "Get over here. Get me the hell out of here as quick as I can. I'll be over by the water tower." Well, the water tower is still there. The hangar is still there. And they went and got Montoya and drove him to their house. And this the fellow's name was Peter Anaya, local Montoyista. And so they kept Montoya at the house to calm him down. He says, "What do you get me a drink? Do you have a drink?" He says, "Well, we got some Jim Beam." He said, "Give me the bottle." He takes the bottle of Jim Beam and glug, 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 glug. He drains the bottle and he collapses, goes to sleep on the couch. But according to Peter and his brother, Ruben Anaya, it was a fitful sleep. He was jerking and he was just in horrible shape. This is even after a bottle of Jim Beam. And so finally he wakes up and he says, "Okay, take me back to the hotel." So they took him back to the Nixon Hotel in Roswell. Well, years later, in 2002, we're making a documentary for the Sci-Fi Channel called The Roswell Crash, Startling New Evidence. It was a two-hour special for the Sci-Fi Channel put together by Don Schmidt and myself. Bryant Gumbel was the host.
Right.
And they interviewed Ruben and Pete Anaya on that show. Well, I was there down in Roswell when they were interviewing them. And I noticed that Pete Anaya's son, who was in his early 30s, was there as well. So I went over to Pete Anaya's son. I said, "Hey, and his son said that he says, "Yes, I worked for Senator Montoya. He was a staffer of Senator Montoya." I said, "Well, did he ever tell you that story about that day down in Roswell?" He said, "Oh, yes, yes, yes." I said, "Well, what are these?" He says, "It was all true. But if anybody ever asked me about it, I will deny it entirely. But it was all true."
Right.
So that gives you they'll talk on the QT, but officially they don't want anything to do with UFOs, Roswell, paranormal, that sort of stuff.
Right, right. I think it was after that sci-fi special aired, you received an email from a woman in Georgia who was a freshman at the University of Georgia back in the early 60s, and she had a roommate from Alabama who had an interesting story to tell about her. Yeah.
That is my longest held lead. That lead lasted me 17 years. That's why when people go, they said, "Well, I'm going to go down to Roswell this weekend and solve that case." Oh yeah, sure you are.
but this involved this involves Operation Paperclip, because I want to get into that. But
yes, well, this lead 17 years. I got this email. This woman in Georgia went to the University of Georgia, and she saw our Sci-Fi Channel special. She wrote to me and said that in 1964, she was a freshman at the University of Georgia, and her roommate, her father, was a German who had come over with Operation Paperclip, and they flew him from Fort Bliss in Texas to Fort Worth to do some research on the wreckage. But while he was there, they told him, don't look at these little bodies. Of course he looked at the little bodies that were there. And I said, oh, my goodness. So for 17 years, and I won't go through all the twists and turns, it took us, let's say, 15 years to find. It turned out to be not the girl's father, but her boyfriend's father.
Hmm.
And we were looking for the wrong name. And it was through a fortuitous publication of an article in a local newspaper down there in Huntsville. The girl was from Huntsville, Alabama, where our space program is. And her brother wrote an article in a newspaper saying, called "Growing Up in a Rocket Family" or something like that. And he had the same last name as this girl at the University of Georgia. And so I sent the article to my source. And she says, "Oh my goodness, we're looking for the wrong guy. We want her boyfriend's father, which had a different name, and we found the daughter that was her former roommate." And so we made plans that she would contact her and try to corroborate the story. Well, she did contact her even in person, but she never asked her the story. So I said, "Oh my God, what am I? You know, this is 17 years now. Yeah, how much longer do you want me to wait?" You know. So I called the girl, the woman myself. She was divorced twice, had two different last names, but we found her. I called her up. This is last year, and first she did. She remembered. Oh yeah, she was my roommate. Yes. Oh yeah. "No, I don't remember that story. No, I don't remember that." And I said, "Oh, because this woman sounded like she was telling the truth." And by the end of her, then she got off the phone, and I heard her talking to somebody in the back. And finally, she came back on. She said, "Well, I can't remember everything I ever said," which to me was a confirmation.
She was walking it back. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. With 17 years.
Oh, my.
For that one witness. That's a record. And I just have to laugh when you say, "Oh, we're going down to Roswell this week. We're going to try to solve that case."
Right. I mean, it is a swamp, isn't it? The whole Roswell investigation. But it does lead us into a little more depth into Operation Paperclip. During which time the United States exfiltrated, I guess, somewhere between 500 and 600 German scientists.
Totally, yeah.
And their families, including, of course, the head of the V-2 rocket program, the rocket man himself, Werner von Braun. We're coming up onto a break here. I just want to start, sort of dip our toe into this conversation about Werner, and then we'll come back. What do we know about von Braun's coming and going at Wright-Patt? Did he spend a lot of time there?
Well, we never thought he did, but we have witnesses who said he was there a lot, and which made sense, you know, being the father of our space program. And he would the witness that I'm thinking of said that he was always accompanied by security people, because he was a paperclip German and very important, but he was always accompanied by security. And they would go into this hangar, stay there and come out. Go into this hangar, stay there. He was always going to the same place at Wright-Patterson. And this particular witness said that he was a guard at this hangar, and that one day this truck pulled up, backed in, and the hangar door closed, and the truck was in there for a while, and then the hangar door opened, and out drove the truck, but there was something underneath the tarp in the back that was, they said it was circular. I think it was the inner cabin that we talked about before, because it was the size and shape of a Volkswagen Beetle under a tarp, just like it was described going down Main Street in 1947. So that was the hangar where they kept the escape capsule or inner cabin. Whether they ever got into it or not, I don't know.
Back with more in a moment.
Shaking the world and seeing what falls. This is The Conspiracy Show with Richard Sarrett from Zoomer Radio.
Thomas, this is a short segment, but we can finish up on the Wernher von Braun story. So was he seen then coming and going from the infamous Blue Room?
Well, you can speculate that it was the Blue Room or Hangar 18, but whether it was one or the other, out came this this artifact from the Roswell crash, this inner cabin escape capsule. We don't know what else was in there, but you can speculate that that's what it was.
He sort of talked in kind of vague terms about the ET presence here on Earth. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Yes, you would figure that being a physicist, space program, rocket development, that he and some of the high-ranking paperclip Germans who were brought over starting in late 1945, and originally they were housed at the Fort Bliss in Texas, would be called to the crash site, and they were. I think the astronaut James Mitchell.
Edgar Mitchell.
Edgar Mitchell. Yeah, I have so many names going. You know what I mean?
I know. I know.
Names, dates, places. Edgar Mitchell mentioned that. And there were others who mentioned that. We had a witness who put him there, plus some of the other high-ranking ones. The Germans felt that they were brought to the site to confirm that it wasn't Russian, that what had crashed was not Russian. Well, they knew right away that it wasn't Russian, and they felt that that was what they wanted from the Germans, was to tell them that whether it was Russian or not. And they, of course, said, no, this is not Russian. So he was at the crash site. And he was very tight-lipped, but at some point he did reveal that in an article in some journal and during a speech somewhere, and I think the words were, we are confronted by a power much greater than our own, something to that effect. And I know I'm butchering the statement, but there was some statement that we are confronted with a power much greater than our own, but we don't know what their home base is.
Right, right.
Yeah, something like that. And so he knew. He knew. Certainly he knew all the higher-ups And he was the top man in the space program, worked for NASA, worked for the Army. We got our first satellite, Explorer 1, up because of him. And he had a second-in-command, was a fellow by the name of Ernst Steinhoff, a physicist, engineer, who had a similar career. But he stayed mostly at Alamogordo with the guided missile program rather than the space program. Although he got interested in the space, and he's in the New Mexico Hall of Fame, and another one as well.
Right.
But these fellows were what's his name? Von Braun died at age 65, which today is young.
Yes.
And Steinhoff died at age 89, just a few years ago. But they were there at the crash site. There were paperclip Germans stationed permanently at Wright-Patterson, and also at Alamogordo, Holloman Air Force Base. So they had a lot to do with our space program. And after World War II, the race was on to get as many of those paperclip Germans as they could, because the Russians were after them as well. But the prize, the big catch, was Werner von Braun.
Right. I think it was from that movie All the Right Stuff about the space race. And one of the astronauts, an American astronaut, says to the other, "Do you think we'll beat the Russians to the moon?" And the other one responds, "Yes, our Nazis are better than their Nazis."
That's true. Because,
right.
you know, the Russians put Sputnik up first before we put Explorer 1 up.
Oh, they were kicking our butt in that regard. Yes. All right, we'll take one final timeout, come back and finish up with Thomas Carey as we take a look inside Wright-Patterson. Stay with us.
Don't be afraid of the dark. The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio. To talk to Richard, call 416-360-0740 or toll free 1-866-740-4740.
Thomas Carey, co-author of UFO Secrets Inside Wright-Patterson, stays with us for a few moments yet. We were talking about Operation Paperclip and Werner von Braun. Now, some of these Nazi scientists that came over and were working inside Wright-Pat, I think in the book you mentioned, and I'm not sure if it was the one who you mentioned in association with von Braun, they went later to work in the private sector, like with the RAND Corporation and so forth, didn't they?
Oh, yes. RAND, I believe, stands for Research and Development. Yes, they, you know, some went to Lockheed, some went to think tanks like RAND. You know, they were the best in the field. They were the best in the field. So
you write in the book that all of the UFO debris and the alien bodies were likely cleared out of Wright-Pat by the mid-1980s. Why was that, and where do you suppose they ended up?
We learned from a fellow who worked at FTD. He worked at FTD, and we got that information because we ourselves did not know. We knew they got the right field, Wright-Patterson, and we knew that there were sightings of individual bodies being autopsied at various places around the country in subsequent years, suggesting that they were lending them out for study. But this fellow that worked at FTD, he said pretty knowledgeably, at least he appeared, that the bodies left Wright Patterson in the early 80s, about 1982-83, for Area 51. So we take his word that, at least, you know, that's what he said, that they went to Area 51. And the reason was because Wright-Patterson, Dayton, Ohio, was getting too built up around Wright-Patterson, and they couldn't. They were fearful of testing aircraft in that congested or that metropolitan area and have one crash in people's neighborhoods. So they needed a place more open, and especially with the testing of these at the time high altitude spy planes. And then later on, the stealth aircraft, the area around Wright Field, in Dayton, was too built up at this time. Plus, there were too many rumors going on about what was there of an extraterrestrial nature. To use an anachronism, the place got too hot. The place got too hot, and they had to do something. So they got rid of at least the bodies. Probably some of the wreckage went elsewhere, but right now, where at least the Roswell bodies are, we had a former head of FTD named George Weinbrenner, General George Weinbrenner, on his deathbed, told somebody that we have five of them in Utah. That would be at Dugway. We believe that the five Roswell cadavers are at Dugway. It's like an Area 51, but in Utah. If there are other bodies, I don't know about where, you know, there are plenty of places they could be, you know, but my own focus was Roswell, where they might be. And we believe that they're currently in Utah.
Subsequent to Roswell, do you know? Do you have knowledge that other UFO crash debris materials were taken to Wright Pat post 47?
Yes, I myself have always been skeptical of additional crashes, but we have a chapter in the book that discusses exactly that, Richard. I'd have to look at the book to tell you which chapter that is, but we have a chapter. It's based on the work of Leonard Stringfield, who in 1978 broke the crash barrier. Up until that point, talking about bodies or extraterrestrial beings and crashes was taboo, even amongst UFO buffs. But he broke the crash barrier in 1978 because he had so many friends. He lived in Cincinnati. He had so many friends at Dayton that lived in Dayton, had worked at Wright, and had heard all the rumors, that he started putting together these monographs called the there were eight of them. And it was all eight were about UFO crashes. And he died in 1994 after his last one. And so we have a whole chapter based on Leonard Stringfield's work, what people told him. Now, the thing about Leonard was that he didn't name his sources, which is unfortunate, because we certainly would follow up to corroborate or, you know, debunk whatever the case may be, but to interview the witnesses. But he did not name in his monographs, that he did not give the names. And it turns out that one of them was Jesse Marcel. That was one of the early ones, was Jesse Marcel. And another fella who we nicknamed Tim was a fellow by the name of Lloyd Thompson, who we knew about, was also at 509th Bomb Group. But we did learn the name of one of the doctors who was there at the autopsy of one of the aliens from Roswell. So we did learn a few of them, but it's all in that chapter. I think it's called Leonard Stringfield and the Little Green Men, I think is the title of the chapter. So as far as the additional crashes. He has the stories that he has in there suggest strongly of a number of additional UFO crashes. Now, I myself have not investigated any of those because Roswell proved to be a labor-intensive undertaking. We've spent the last quarter century solely on Roswell because there were so many witnesses, we have hundreds, that know their little piece of the story. None of them go beyond their little piece of the story. And it was our job, like a puzzle, like a jigsaw puzzle, to put them all together into a coherent narrative, which I believe that we have done. And the second part of that narrative is what happened at Wright-Patterson after the material and the bodies were taken there.
Well, Thomas, I know that Stanton is looking down and and thinking about you and Don and saying to himself, job well done, a job well done. UFO Secrets Inside Wright-Patterson, how can people get a hold of the book?
The Barnes & Noble, of course, is our book distributor, Barnes & Noble. And most people go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble online. You can get it there. I have to check to see if you can get it through our website. But most people, I know myself, when I order a book, non-UFO book, I go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble. And you can take a look at our website, www.roswellinvestigator.com. And that's pretty much where these days you can buy your books. I suspect you buy your books at Amazon, too.
When possible, I like to buy them directly from the author. So, people should go to roswellinvestigator.com first to see if they can get the book there. That would be good. Thomas, what a pleasure. Thank you so much. And thank you for UFO Secrets Inside Wright-Patterson.
Thank you, Richard. It was a distinct pleasure talking to you.
All right, that's it for me. Next week on the program, The Science of Spirit Possession for the full 2 hours. My thanks to Owen Wolf and Ryan White. In the meantime, don't be afraid. There's nothing concealed that won't be revealed, and nothing hidden that won't be made known. What you hear in the dark, speak in the light. What I say in a whisper, proclaim from the housetops. Move over, Aphrodite, I'm coming home. Good night.
You're listening to The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio.
Back with Thomas Carey, and he is with us for the full 2 hours talking about UFO secrets inside Wright-Patterson eyewitness accounts from the real Area 51. The co-author is Don Schmidt, who joined us last week on the program. Thomas, we were talking about nitinol, which was reverse engineered from this memory material that many of us first heard about from Jesse Marcel Jr. because he remembers his father, Jesse Sr., who was the intelligence officer at the 509, bringing this big box of debris into the kitchen. And he sat down and he was, I guess, kind of playing with it. He also talked about, of course, the I-beam with those strange hieroglyphics on it. And you talk about sort of the four types of wreckage that were taken to Wright-Pat. We mentioned the memory material. I just talked about the I-beam. What else? What else? What were the other two types?
There was, of course, metal that was unbendable, you know, very thin, unbendable, couldn't destroy it. They took a 15-pound sledgehammer to it, just bounced off. So you had the rigid metal, the memory metal, the I-beams, and you had things that reminded people of what today we called monofilaments, you know, that you send instead of wire, you know, which is like this Do I got that right? Monofilaments?
Like a fiber optic kind of?
Fiber, that's it. See, when you get old, Richard, you can't come up. Fiber optics, yes. That was the other one. And I may be leaving one or two out, but I think Jesse talked about something that was like Bakelite.
Bakelite
material. And I don't know what that would be, but he said it was like Bakelite. And that's pretty much – most of it was this memory metal. And, of course, there was the inner part of the ship, the inner cabin, we call it, or an escape pod. It was an egg-shaped craft, seamless, about the size of a Volkswagen Beetle, egg-shaped, that went another 35 miles and came to rest closer to Roswell. So that was when the craft exploded, everything went to smithereens, and that's what came down on the rancher Mac Brazel's sheep pasture. But the inner cabin or escape pod, we don't know which one it was, that survived the explosion, whether it was internal or external, we don't know. We speculate that it might have been lightning strike. That's speculation. But that came to rest another 35 miles from the debris field. So that's pretty much just thinking about it. We list the different types of wreckage in the book.
Yes.
And I think that's pretty much.
Yeah, I think you covered the four main ones, but of course you refer to the memory material as the Holy Grail.
You know why?
No.
Because any of the other types of wreckage you would have to send out to get it analyzed. And even when it's analyzed and if it comes back that it's otherworldly, oh, no, you did something wrong. It's not, you know what I mean?
Right.
But the memory metal, you can say, okay, here's a piece of memory metal. Watch what I do to it. And you hold it up and it just unfurls itself. And it just floats there. You say, "Oh my goodness, we still don't have anything like that." So that's why it's the Holy Grail, because you can tell in an instant that we don't have anything like that. Where the other stuff, you got to send it out, and it's months and months and months, and everybody's forgotten about it. And you say, "Oh, whatever happened to that piece of metal that so and so sent out?" And so that's why we're looking for the memory metal, not that other stuff. We'll take anything, you know. We'll take anything, but the memory metal is the most. It was the most numerous pieces of wreckage. It was the memory metal, and it's also the easiest to tell that it's really something that we don't have yet.
At what point and in what capacity did Uri Geller get involved?
Oh, my goodness. Uri Geller, the mentalist, they conducted this was in the Dr. Wang, I believe, was in charge of this. He was trying to it had to do with the memory metal and whether they could activate mentally this memory metal in some way, either make it bend or something like that. It was, and Dr. Wang actually admitted that he had Uri Geller in for this project, but he absolutely didn't want to talk about it. But the idea was that the ship maybe was piloted or driven by some sort of mental activity rather than a shifter, you know, and a steering wheel, that it was all mental. And that wasn't the chapter I wrote, but that's pretty much Uri Geller was involved in that with the Dr. Wang project. And I don't know what became of it, but the idea of, you know, maybe the ship was, maybe it was all mental, is something that people consider.
Right. You mentioned the nitinol, which, you know, was a reverse engineering, as best we could, as you put it, of the this memory material. Then we had these rumors that things like, you know, transistors. We had transistor radios. There didn't seem to be any sort of transition between the vacuum tube and these transistor radios. So some people speculated that was a gift from the Roswell UFO crash. Things like, we mentioned fiber optic cable, night vision binoculars. How likely is that, given the fact that, again, you know, such a conundrum trying to apply 1940s terrestrial science to this advanced technology?
Well, here's the thing, Richard, is I hate to say that armed conflict, i.e. wars, there's a benefit. One of the benefits of war, and I hate to use that term, is that there are new developments in all of these areas, not necessarily what we're talking about, but new things are developed. For instance, I had an operation some years ago called a colostomy, where they take part of your large intestine out. I had a perforated, what do you call them things, diverticulum. I would have died, but it came from the battlefield. Wounded soldiers that were shot in the, you know, you punctured their large intestine, so they would cut out the part that was, you know, damaged, and they tap back together again, and that came from war. So there are things that come from developed during wars. Now, 1947, you're 2 years post-World War II. Things like transistors and all that stuff, it's, in my view anyway, I'm not discounting it, but it's speculation. Whereas for me, the nitinol, again, there was no history whatsoever of any studies of self-healing metal, shape-shifting metal, prior to after the Roswell crash with this memory metal. But things like Kevlar, even Velcro, they say, oh, Velcro came from the Roswell crash. Night vision goggles, and I'm thinking, oh, my goodness. There's just not enough, for me, substantiation for those things. You can speculate, but there has to be more substantive evidence of that, at least for me.
All right, Thomas, we'll take another quick time out. We'll come back, begin hour two. We'll talk about Colonel Philip Corso the day after Roswell. We'll talk about Operation Paperclip. Wernher von Braun comes to Wright Pat. Back with more of my conversation with Thomas Carey right here on The Conspiracy Show. Stay with us.
Live from Toronto, Canada, Earth, The Conspiracy Show with Richard Sarrett on Zoomer Radio.
Thanks for inviting me into your home, long-haul truck, RV, camper, taxi, your parents' basement, your loft, that greasy spoon just off the interstate, and your cabin in the woods. Welcome to everyone listening in on our flagship station, Zoomer Radio in Toronto, those tuning in on one of our affiliate stations, and those who stream us on zoomerradio.ca or the Zoomer Radio app and the Conspiracy Show app. Those of you who subscribe to the YouTube channel, Strange Planet, however and wherever you're listening, I bid thee the warmest of welcomes, and I thank you for your fine company. We are back with Thomas Carey, co-author, along with Don Schmidt, of UFO Secrets Inside Wright-Patterson Eyewitness Accounts from the Real Area 51. We mentioned earlier the Foreign Technology Division, previously known as T2 at Wright-Pat, where aircraft belonging to adversaries were taken, certainly during the Cold War. They tried to reverse engineer it. Then along comes Colonel Philip Corso, talking about his work at the Foreign Technology Division. How much of the day after Roswell? How much of his account is credible?
That's a good question. We, for some reason, we always get questions about Corso, because I think, as far as UFO books go, that a lot of people read that book the day after Roswell. And what I didn't like about the book was that there were no footnotes or endnotes. Nothing was substantiated. It was like a fiction book, but it was nonfiction. No index. Senator Strom Thurmond into writing a foreword for the book. Strom Thurmond didn't know it was a UFO book, and he made all these glowing comments about Corso. Soon as he found out that it was a UFO book, he said, I'm out of this. Take me out of this." So he fooled Strom Thurmond. The other things, like he mentioned, the bodies going to Fort Riley in Kansas. We don't have any knowledge of that. I mean, we pretty much know where the bodies went and when they went and how many there were. But he's got them at Fort Riley, Kansas, and at a date when they were still out in the field. Things like that. And also, he was a lieutenant colonel, if I recall. And this would be too big of a project to run for a lieutenant colonel, at least in my opinion. And I think that he was working for General Trudeau, who was the guy's name. And Trudeau says, "Oh, we got this cabinet over here full of Roswell files. See what you get." You know, I'm thinking, "Oh my goodness, what are you doing here?" It's just, the whole thing to me just did not hang together. Now, Corso had a distinguished military career. A lieutenant colonel is. I mean, there are plenty of them. The next grade, full colonel, is where you really are somebody. Anything below full colonel is sort of, it's almost, you know, sometimes the it's a gift that they give you a lieutenant colonel rating. But I just thought the rating for that project should have been in a higher grade classification. But
right, like General Twining, who ended up, as you say, chair of the Joint Chiefs.
Yes. Corso, we thank him for his service, but I don't know what he was looking at. And a lot of the stuff in there, to me, read like a fiction. And like I said, he was in charge of the back engineering projects, I guess. But like I said, the only project that I know that has been substantiated, we have the progress reports from Battelle Institute to Wright-Patterson. We have those progress reports, and you know, thanks to our associate in Florida, Anthony Bregaglia. But Corso, you're just relying on him. And the thing in his favor, though, is he seemed to have had a good life. He didn't need this to make a name for himself. He had a fine military career, and making statements like he did is going out on a limb. So in that respect, I have to consider it, because he was out on a limb when he didn't have to be.
Can you even place him based on your research? Can you place him at Wright-Patterson?
No. We can't.
What's interesting is about that book is The Day After Roswell. That book, from my understanding, is what led our former defense minister, deputy prime minister, the Honorable Paul Hellyer, to first seriously delve into the whole UFO ET issue. It was that very book.
That was a New York Times bestseller. The goal of every authors to get on the New York Times bestseller list, and that book was made it. And I'm trying to think of another UFO book that did, and I can't. So a lot of people read that book, and I didn't know Paul Hellyer, that was his inspiration, but well, there you go.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to take a minute. We didn't do this in hour one, but we talked a little bit about, you know, the 18 building complex, A through G and Hangar 23. But just kind of give us a sense of the size and the scope of Wright-Patterson above ground and below.
Well, I was never there. Don has been there. I have never been there, but going by some of the witnesses that we talked to, they felt that most of 90% of Wright-Patterson is underground, because you drive around, you see an empty field, but you see these air vents coming up out of the ground. So it's in our book of people who've gone to Wright-Patterson that they're struck by the fact that there's a lot of open space, but they have these signs that and the percentage that we heard was like 90% of Wright-Patterson is underground. And we do have statements in the book from fellows who they're dead now, but actually helped build the various subterranean levels. And they saw things down there. And so, yeah, you know, it was a strategic air command base, a SAC base, but they want to have things bomb proofed so they can function if we're ever attacked, and so a lot of it is in subterranean vaults and caverns and things like that. And what's interesting is this Hangar 23/18. We know there were at least four subterranean levels to that. We had vaults back there, and someone even said they saw an aircraft down there. But in recent years, I find this interesting, all of that has been cemented over.
Ah.
All of that has been cemented over. So you can't get down to any of those lower levels where all the action was. And I just find that interesting.
But part of Wright Pat is open to the public, right? To tourists and students,
yes,
and things like that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That, they have our last chapter is called the it's something about, let me look at it. It's In the Shadow of Ghosts. Yes, In the Shadow of Ghosts is our last chapter. It's about visitors to Wright-Patterson today. The base is full of ghosts from things like what we're talking about. And a lot of people ask about Hangar 8. Hangar 18 is the number one question they have. And, of course, there never was one, but some of them will admit that there were things stored there, but they don't know any more than that. So
I want to take some time and talk about the late Senator Barry Goldwater and his, well, it seemed like for decades, he tried desperately to take a peek inside Wright Pat. I mean, and here is a distinguished senator from Arizona who sat on the Armed Services Committee, the Aeronautical and Space Sciences Committee. He was the chair of the Strategic Nuclear Forces Committee. And yet he asks to go see Wright Patterson and he's shut down. Now, who is this General Curtis LeMay, and how and why does he have the power to tell Senator Goldwater, you're not allowed?
Well, he was the Air Force Chief of Staff. That was his power. Curtis Bombs Away LeMay was a hero from World War II. And by 1961, he rose to become the Air Force Chief of Staff with four stars. And that's a full general. That's not like a, that's not a five star. It's a full four star general. So he's Air Force Chief of Staff. Barry Goldwater is a respected senator from New Mexico, Arizona, in the U.S. Senate, chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee. So he's a powerful man. And he was respected on both sides of the aisle, unlike today's politics. He was also a UFO buff, and he was also a major general, that's two stars, in the Air Force Reserve. So he's wearing several hats. He's a U.S. senator. He's a general in the Air Force Reserve. Man of great talent. And he ran for president in 1964. He lost to Lyndon Johnson in a landslide, which was the post-Kennedy assassination first election after that. So a lot of sympathy going there. So he's out in Wright-Patterson. And then we figure this is 1963 now. 1963. Because LeMay was chairman of the chief of staff from 1961 to 1965 when he retired. So this is 1963. And so Goldwater's at Wright-Patterson. And he's heard about Roswell from his good friend, William Blanchard, General Blanchard. He was a colonel back in 47 at the base, on the base.
The 509, yeah.
509th Bomb Group and base commander. He was a full colonel. And he rises to four stars himself by age 50. Blanchard has four stars. He's going to be the next chief of staff in the Air Force. He dies at age 50 as the vice chief of staff in 1966. But Goldwater learned about Roswell and this so-called blue room at Wright-Patterson where all the alien artifacts were stored. That was the rumor. So he's at Wright-Patterson. He said, I wonder if I I'm interested in flying saucer. I heard about this. I'm going to call up LeMay just to make sure. He says, General, I'm here at Wright-Patterson. I've heard about this room where you have all of this alien stuff. Might I go in there? And he said it was the first time he ever heard LeMay lose it because they were good friends. He said he dressed me up one side and down the other. No, you can't go in there. Hell no, you can't go in there. I can't go in there. And don't you ever ask me that again or I'll see that you're court-martialed. Well, thank goodness they were friends, huh?
Oh, my God. So, yeah, some friend.
Yes. So Goldwater said he tried a few more times there, but then he finally gave up. He couldn't get anywhere. And whether it was LeMay himself could not get in there. Maybe it was just to put an exclamation point on what he was saying, but maybe also he was banned as well by whoever was controlling that, and we don't know who that is himself, so we don't know. But we heard it from another witness who was there at the time. He says, boy, that was the buzz on the base for a couple of days that Goldwater was turned down by LeMay from going into this blue room.
Now, getting back to Colonel William Blanchard, commanding officer at the 509 in Roswell during the UFO incident, and he tells Goldwater, what, that everything that you've heard about Roswell is true?
Well, yes. I mean, he's not going to lie to Goldwater. I mean, they're good friends. They're both Air Force generals. And he knew that Goldwater was a UFO buff, but interested in UFOs. And, whether he was on a flight somewhere, we don't know. But that's where Goldwater learned about the Blue Room and about the artifacts and Roswell, that Roswell was real. It was from his good friend. And he says that Blanchard was his good friend. So that's who he learned it from.
And as you say, Blanchard was kind of fast-tracked to go to the top, but died of, I think it was a massive heart attack at his desk at the age of 50. Are we sure that was a heart attack, Thomas?
Yeah, well, that's what we're told. It was at his desk. What's interesting, see, is Blanchard is was a West Point graduate. He was a football and ice hockey star. For your Toronto visitors, listeners, Blanchard was an ice hockey star as well as a football star. He was 6'4" or 6'5", which was tall in those days. He had movie star good looks. Every other officer in the Air Force knew that he was going to be chief of staff someday. You know how it is, that you have that sun spotlight on you. And he couldn't wait to get rid of that. When the Roswell crash happened, he could not wait to have someone else take that over. Ramey took it over, Roger Ramey.
Right.
And even Ramey knew that Blanchard would surpass him one day in rank. And so Blanchard was happy that someone else took over this, because he didn't want anything on his record that would besmirch his record to the top. And that's what his eye, he had the eye on the prize, which was chief of staff.
What would that have meant, though, for disclosure? Just think of, we have the commanding officer at the 509 during Roswell, who is admitted to, you know, the former chair of some very powerful Senate committees, that Roswell is true. There were aliens. There was UFOs. They crashed. They were taken to Wright-Patterson. And now all of a sudden, you know, we have Blanchard as ultimately becoming, you know, maybe a full four-star general on the Joint Chiefs of Staff. I mean, what would that have meant to have a guy like that in that position? What would that have meant for disclosure?
He did not want to be his name in the same paragraph as UFOs or Roswell. He wanted to get as far away from that Roswell thing as he could, because Roswell, UFOs is still a taboo subject to people in the limelight, whether you're talking especially politicians. They don't want to – don't put my name in that story.
Except he'd already told Goldwater, and then Goldwater writes about it in a book. So the cat's out of the bag.
Well, Blanchard was already dead.
True. Yeah.
So, Blanchard was written about in 1980 in the Roswell incident. So he's dead and buried. So it's, you know, that can't hurt him anymore.
No, but I'm just wondering, had he lived, though?
Had he lived?
Yeah.
UFOs is viewed as an impediment. If you're looking to rise,
right?
Especially in the military, where this is still, you know, the Air Force position is that it was a Project Mogul balloon, and that the little bodies were these dime store mannequins from the – that's mannequins.
Right.
That's their official position. You don't want to go challenging that if you want to go up to the top. You want to show that you're a team player. So wouldn't have meant anything.
He would have denied it, or he would have maybe, had he lived, he would have told Barry, hey, you know, do me a favor. Don't just leave my name out of that book.
I'll give you another example. Senator Joseph Montoya from New Mexico.
Yes.
Back in 1947. Was the lieutenant governor of New Mexico.
Thomas, can I just get you to hold that story for the next segment? Because I love this story. It's a great one. Hold on. We'll come back. Thomas Carey, as we continue to delve into Wright-Patterson, the real Area 51, right here on The Conspiracy Show.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.